Great job, everyone. And what a great song. And I trust today, as has already been stated by Pastor Derek, it's already been stated through his songs, even just this one. If today you don't know what it is to have a real and vibrant relationship with Jesus, to have assurance that you're forgiven, you know what's going to happen to you when you die. If you don't have that, today's the day to have that. So I'm going to encourage you, my friends, at the end of service, if you have questions, let's not leave today till we answer those questions or set up a time to answer those questions as well. The Gospel of Luke is where we are at as we continue in our series, Luke chapter number 12. Now, if you have a paper copy of God's Word, you open it to the middle, come across like Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, keep going to the right, you'll come across Matthew, Luke, John, all those eventually. Or just take out your phone and Google Luke chapter number 12. I want to see right from God's Word what it has to say to you and I today. God has clarity for you today about Him, you, this life, others, and the next life. We always want to take advantage of having His Word. So Luke chapter number 12 is where we are at. Now, before we read our passage, I want you to imagine for a moment. You've received this invitation to an informational event. Maybe it's from a boss, a coworker, a family member, a neighbor, whatever it might be. And it's about this incredible new organization taking place and taking shape here in the Dayton area. And they're promising to be greater than like a Rotary Club, greater than, say, the Optimist Club, or maybe like the Shriners. They're promising to be those things and more. Yeah, if you're like me, you're probably like, okay, whatever. A little skeptical or maybe even dismissive. But imagine you receive this and you decide, you know what, I'm going to go just out of curiosity or concern based on how it'll impact the relationship of the person who's invited me. So you decide you're going to go to this informational event. And once there, you catch a vibe. It's electric. There's synergy, there's purpose, the excitement is almost palpable. There's just an event there that you didn't expect to have. It starts with a presentation. It's just fantastic. They say, with your involvement, here's what our purpose and goals are. And they start to lay out something kind of large and funnel and then start to get more and more specific. We aim to change our communities and our cities and our state and impact even our nation. It's like, okay, you know, I've heard this before, whatever. And then they start to bring it in. We are going to intentionally work on those who have been wrongfully incarcerated and help bring justice to their cause. They lay out a plan for that. You're like, okay. Then they say, we're going to help not only those who are wrongfully incarcerated, we're going to help them after they're out or those who are out of incarceration reintegrate in a healthy way into society so there's not just reciprocation. Okay, I like it. And then they start saying, beyond that, we're going to look to help families who have lost their children to the foster care system come back to a healthy status as a family to be reunited. You're like, okay, I like it when I'm here. This is good. And they say, beyond that, we're going to enlist new foster families to help those who lose their guardians or aren't able to reunify. You're like, all right. And then they're saying, and then it's not done. There's more. We're going to help those who have food insecurity find a place of free help and resources. We already have this many pantries lined out, this many big onboarded names and companies. Okay. And it just keeps getting better and better as they lay out this plan of how they are going to intentionally help not only communities, but cities, our state, and even try to impact the nation at large. And as their convincing plans roll out more and more, you find yourself with less reservations, less skepticism, and you're like, I might be on board with this, actually. So they finish the pitch, as it were. They say, if you're interested, let's stay together here. Everybody else can be dismissed. We want to get to know you in a more intimate way, kind of discuss this. So that happens, and you're sitting there, and they start laying out this plan, and they say, okay, I know you're probably waiting for the catch to drop, right? And you're right, there are some catches. And they go to this guy over here like, Jimmy, we're not going to lie. If you get involved, all that we've talked about in upending society in a good way can take place. But guess what, though? It won't be without cost to you. It may cost you your relationship with your mother-in-law. He laughs. He's like, don't threaten me with a good time, right? Okay, sign me up today, you know? And everybody kind of laughs, and they move on. They point over to another, well, hey, Sally, is it? Yeah, Sally. Well, hey, thanks for being here tonight. Listen, I want you to know it may make it awkward, perhaps, with the other moms in the playgroup that you're in. She says, hey, for the cost of what will be accomplished, that's worth it. I can always find more moms to hang out with. Everybody's like, yeah, that's right. And so there's this kind of this vibe building, like, we can do this. Yeah, this is, I want to be a part of this. The cost isn't that bad. This is great. It's not expensive as far as to join. There's no cost there. It just sounded like there could be some relational friction because of what will be accomplished. Look, another guy like, hey, I know you want to do this and be involved, and it sounds like you're willing to commit some time. And they go to him, and he's like, Joe, are you willing to do this? He's like, I'm on board. Just hear what I'm hearing. They're like, great. What it likely may mean in a few years is you get incarcerated. And everybody's like, huh?
Whoa, what?
It's like when those record screeches. Wait, he just has to get rid of his mother-in-law. That's a pretty light price. She just has to find some new moms. I might go to jail over this? What are you talking about? Did I miss something? Where did we go? And they're like, yeah, don't worry. And the presenter just kind of goes on to the next thing. And they're like, hey, ma'am over here, you seem like you're really excited about it. I just want you to recognize it's also going to cost you, Sally, this issue of your finances. We're going to expect you to upend your budget. And we're going to expect you to, in a very significant way, say no to what you have been spending, how you have been living. We're going to need you to tighten that thing up. And we're going to expect to see significant donations here to the organization. Suddenly we've gone from like, okay, yeah, I can be a part of this, to like, these costs are getting real now. They're getting real serious. And I don't know if I want the commitment or not. And we would hear something like that at an event and start to question, I think I may have walked into a cult. This isn't Amway. It's way worse. It's just, you know what? I just realized everybody under 40, Amway's a pyramid scheme. So you'll have to Google that later. Everybody who's older, you know what I'm talking about, right? We'd hear something like that, and all of a sudden, wait. The prices didn't seem bad up front, but now they're way worse. They're way too unrealistic, and here's where we'd be struggling. I'm not sure I'm ready to give that kind of allegiance over to just some fledgling organization that doesn't have track record and may come with such a significant cost that I'm not ready to give. In fact, not a chance. Now, this morning, as we read our passage, Jesus is actually going to give the original audience and you and I the similar situation. It's not an earthly organization with a plan on a hype train. It's a call to understand what's required for his future kingdom, but also how it morphs and changes and conforms your life and my life now as his follower. So that said, let's pick up at Luke chapter 12 where we've been going through. Luke chapter number 12 and verse 32 is where we pick up. As we talk about, there's only one kingdom worth living for. There's only one kingdom worth living for. So we're picking up in verse 32 where we left off last time. Jesus says this, "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's," what's the next two words? "Good pleasure." It's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Now we start seeing some of the obligation. Sell that you have. Give alms. Provide yourselves bags which wax not old, a treasure in the heavens that faileth not, where no thief approacheth, neither moth corrupts. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Let your loins be girded about, and the lights burning. And ye yourselves, like unto men that wait for the Lord, when he will return from the wedding, that when he cometh and knocks on the door, you'd open it to him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you, that he shall gird himself, and make them to sit down at meat, and will come forth and serve them. And if he shall come in the second watch, or come in the third watch, and find them so, blessed are those servants. And this know, that if the good man of the house had known what hour the thief would have come, he would have watched, and not have suffered his house to be broken through. Be ye therefore ready also, for the Son of Man cometh at an hour when you think not. So this is not a light message. And here's Peter's response to verse 41. Peter says unto Jesus, Lord, speakest thou this parable unto us or to everyone? And the Lord said, Who then is that is faithful and a wise steward? whom is Lord shall make ruler over his household to give them their portion of meat in due season. Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Of a truth, I say unto you, that he will make him ruler over all that he hath. But, and if that servant say in his heart, my Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to beat the men servants and the maidens, and to eat and to drink, and to be drunken, the Lord of that servant will come in a day when he looketh not for him, and at an hour when he's not aware, and catch this, will cut him asunder, and will appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. And that servant which knew his Lord's will, and prepared not himself, neither did according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes. But he that knew not, and did commit things worthy of stripes, shall be beaten with few stripes. For unto whosoever much is given, of him shall much be required. And to whom much has been committed, they will be asked the more. I'm come to send fire on the earth. And what will I, if it be already kindled? But I have a baptism to be baptized with. And how am I straitened till it's accomplished? Suppose ye that I'm come to give peace on earth? I tell you not, but rather division. From henceforth, there shall be five in one house, divided three against two and two against three. The father shall be against the son against the father, the mother against the daughter against the mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And Jesus said to the people, when you see a cloud rise out of the west, straightway you say, there cometh a shower, and so it is. And when you see the south wind blow, you say, there shall be heat, and it comes to pass. Ye hypocrite, ye can discern the face of the sky and of the earth, but how is it that you do not discern this time? Yea, and why even of yourselves judge not what is right? When thou goest with thine adversary to the magistrate, as thou art in the way, give diligence that thou may be delivered from him, lest he bring you to the judge deliver you to the officer, and the officer cast you into prison. I tell you, thou shalt not depart thence till thou hast paid the very last mite. Here in our passage, Jesus is continuing on a series of teachings that are not only controversial, they're also very upending in your ideology for this life, what you and I would value, what the listeners would have valued and pursued. Remember, so far in chapter 12, he opened it in verses 1 through 12 saying, we're to fear God. We're to be in awe of God. We're to live in respect to God and eternal understanding rather than fear man and estimate our own opinions as greater than God. And then he goes on past verse 12, and what does he talk about in verse number 11 or 13 through 21? He talks about pursuing this realm with its riches is a mistake. We're to pursue the Lord's realm and eternally what's valuable. And then as we saw last week from verses 22 through 31, he talked about keeping the concern of God's kingdom our main concern. That brings alleviation from anxiety after pursuing this realm. Now Jesus concludes this discourse by highlighting the value of living for this life in spiritual service to his desire for his future kingdom. Now, let's remember, God has promised Israel, the original hearer here, the original audience that he's talking to, God has promised from the Old Testament on to the nation of Israel that they would have indeed a future messianic king who would rightfully reign literally in Jerusalem. He would be a righteous judge. He would be a perfect high priest and intercessor on their behalf. Now, they had imperfect representations. Remember that Aaron in the Old Testament, they had the tribe of Levi in the Old Testament. They had King David in the Old Testament. And these were all what I'd call imperfect shadows or pictures of who the Messiah would be and what he would accomplish. So Israel has been longing for this king, for this perfect high priest. Now, Jesus will detail how it's a privilege to not only anticipate the Messiah, him, but understand and anticipate his future reign on the earth, which wasn't going to take place in their time and has not taken place in ours. Jesus cautions his followers to review their current lives because of that future coming kingdom. And if there's a thought for you and I to see this week and next week, it's this. The life, this life that we have, it's only properly understood, lived, and enjoyed when we submit it to the reality of Jesus' kingdom. Anything less is reckless. So I understand it. You have your thoughts about life. I have my thoughts about life. God's given us autonomy, but there's also accountability in our autonomy to recognize that what he has said is best, it's righteous, it's correct, and you and I are to submit to that. Once we do, you know what we find? That's where life really begins. That's where life is truly enjoyed. That's where life is truly valuable. But as we see throughout this passage, you can say no to that, but it is at reckless abandon and great cost to you. It will not be good for you. It will not be good for those around you. And ultimately, you and I will stand before the Lord one day, and in eternity, we will be judged clearly and appropriately because of that. So we think about the kingdom that's worth living for, Jesus' future kingdom, his preparation for that now in the present. Here's the first thought we want to walk into. What might keep someone from living for Jesus' kingdom? What might keep someone from living for Jesus' kingdom? It seems like that is the idea that Jesus has in mind here in verse 32. Remember, he's talked about anxiety and living for this realm, and now he's shifting it very starkly to talk about living for his realm. And what does he begin with there in verse number 32? He starts with two words indicating our likelihood to indulge in it. What does he say? He says, fear not, fear not. A likely answer to this question, who might not live for the kingdom? Why wouldn't somebody live for the kingdom? Is because they're unsure of what it would be for them. And they're unsure how it will upend their life. Is doing this in the present, living my life for a future kingdom I have not seen, will it be worth it? Jesus says, fear not. They can reject a sense of dread, a sense of mistrust or concern about anticipating his future kingdom and conforming their lives around that. They can say no to that based on the assurance of who Christ is and what he has desired for them. This is a command, okay? This is an imperative. He says, fear not, but it also functions as what? Also a calming and reassuring word. It is a command, but it is a calming word for them to recognize the kingdom is coming. You can be a part of it here and now, friend. But I want you to recognize all that you're concerned about has been resolved and answered in Christ, and it will be worth it. And how does he elaborate this? He says, fear not. And then what does he call them? My flock. He's echoing here the words, of course, of the well-known king, as we cited earlier, David from Psalm 23. The Lord is my what? Shepherd, indicating God cared for Israel as a shepherd would his sheep in the provision and the safety in their well-being. And it's the same with us. Jesus Christ is called the good shepherd of our souls, right? So he says, fear not, you're my flock. Even though he would say, I'm going to send you as lambs amongst wolves. He said that back in chapter number 10. They didn't have to fear. Why? Because God, their great shepherd, was with them. And then to add yet another level of reassurance about living for him, note what he says here. It's God's desire to give the kingdom. This is a beneficial end state, the kingdom, rooted in God's character. The promised kingdom of righteousness will be fulfilled in the future. That's without question. But the spiritual freedom will be seen now in his work going on in their lives. Now, pause to consider that for a second. He says, fear not, it's God's desire to give you the kingdom. We know that when it comes to not fearing something or someone and receiving a gift from someone, it's only as good as their character and their capacity to deliver, right? Some of you have already received invitations from people. Maybe it's in your family, maybe it's your friends to go to Thanksgiving. And I suspect you've received one. Maybe you're the one giving the offering. If you're going to somebody's house for Thanksgiving, what are you confident they're going to do? They're going to feed you. And hopefully, they're not just feeding you Little Caesar's pizza. I don't know if they're open on Thanksgiving, but right? Hopefully, they're not serving you some burnt Marie Callender's pie, right? You have confidence that the person offering, extending the invitation, has good character and capacity to deliver on what they have and given or extended. Here, the great shepherd of their soul says what? Fear not. You're not wrong for having those concerns and questions. You're frail. You're finite. I know your frame. I made you. But here's what you need to remember. I'm the one making the promise as the good shepherd of your soul. I'm the one who is the promised high priest and perfect king. I will set up my kingdom on this earth in my due time. You can live in anticipation of that now in great confidence and calmness and assurance because of who I am, what I have the capacity to deliver on. I am right. So note how he then directs them to live. He says, fear not, you're my flock. It's my good pleasure to give you the kingdom in verse 33. Then what does he tell them? Now it's on them. Not just a choice of trust, but obedience, faith, and works. What does he say? Sell what you got and give it to the poor. I imagine there's a listener there like, okay, you know, I was a little on the fence, Jesus, but if you're promising it, I'm in. I'm in. And then he says, sell and give to the poor. I'm out. I'm out. Wait, this is going to change my pocketbook? Whoa, Jesus, you're supposed to be bringing in the kingdom. Now, I read this, and maybe you're different than me. I hope you are. I read this with a bit of cynical or skeptical eyes. Is Jesus here telling them they got to sell absolutely everything and give it to every poor person they come across, distribute to every poor person they see, that is what is required, that the love of God be seen through an act of benevolence over and over every single day until their bank account is at zero? Is that what Jesus is demanding here for every Christian? Not necessarily. Give me a moment to say it. The context of this chapter, as well as Jesus' other teachings, help demonstrate to us that Jesus is attempting to give what? A stark jolt to what would be their materialistic outlook and their confidence in their riches, their confidence in their finances, their confidence in their wealth, and also their misplaced hope that when the Messiah comes in, he will deliver an unparalleled financial reign and prosperity for Israel. That Rome will be put to the side, Israel will be established, and they're just going to have money in the streets from being a part of the Jewish covenant nation, and the Messiah's here, and we've got money. Jesus is having to say what? That's not the goal of being my follower. That's not even the goal of the kingdom. Jesus wants them to recognize how prone they are, and can we just insert how prone you are, how prone what I am, of being guilty of greediness. Didn't he just talk about that earlier in the chapter? Beware of covetousness. Beware of being greedy, just like the Roman counterparts they despise, just like the Pharisees and the Sadducees whom they despised, said the religious leaders. He's asking them to check their motives. Check your heart. You want to be all in on the kingdom? Yes, Jesus. Then be willing to do what I've called and commanded you to do with the finances I have graciously given you for my purposes, not yours. Sell what you have and give to the poor. You know what Jesus is hammering here? Maybe we'd summarize it simply. People over things. People over things. Maybe we could add to that, his desire for people over things. Then what does he call them to do? Store up what's truly valuable. He talks here about having purses without holes, having treasures that don't fail, idea of the purse is there's just the kind of a pouch or a sack that they would hold their money in. I happen to have a pair of jeans right now that for some reason the interior lining in the pocket has severed from the front part of the pants. And so you know what I keep doing? Number one, I keep wearing these pants, hallelujah. Number two, I keep going to put my keys in my pocket, and what do I feel go down my leg? Whoop, like, there they are. You know, that represents a hole in my purse, as it were, my purse. I got a problem here. I'm losing something valuable just because of what I keep putting in to be contained in. Jesus here is giving the parallel. If this is striking you as offensive, that your finances belong to me, your net worth is because of my kindness. The items you possess are at my disposal and my good pleasure. If this is offending you, you've got the wrong economy in mind. You're thinking everything else is valuable. You're thinking your purposes matter. It's like you have this cup with a hole that just keeps draining. You keep pouring in, it keeps draining. You keep pouring in, it keeps draining. He says, it's foolish, it's worthless, it's even wasted. And he goes beyond that then. He goes beyond that to try to show just how susceptible they are. If you're a familiar Bible reader, this passage reminds you of what you likely already know. What's he highlight here? He says, sell what you have there in verse 33, give to the poor, provide for yourselves bags that wax not old, a treasure that doesn't fail. And then he highlights what living for God in his economy, his kingdom, is not subject to. Thieves, right? So theft and decay. Theft and decay. Now, in their time, it was easier for thieves to get in because their walls were typically made of some kind of baked clay, and so you could dig through a wall, steal something, be in and out. I sometimes wonder how that sounded and how hard it would be, but if nobody was around, you could probably get in and out relatively simply. He talks about moths as well. Moths in their time were a real problem because people did not have a lot of money, and therefore they did not have a lot of extra sets of clothes. You and I, no matter how rich or poor you feel you are, you have a lot more clothes than people in the New Testament had for the average individual. Wealthy people had multiple changes of clothes, and guess what a concern for theirs was? Don't let the moths do what? Put holes all throughout it, right? Jesus here is saying, if you think your wealth and your net worth and your possessions and everything you treasure is valuable here on this earth is at your disposal, you've grossly mistaken how durable those items are, and you have misunderstood how susceptible they are to change. I like swapping stuff. I like buying stuff, swapping stuff. It's just fun. It's therapeutic. I don't know why. Anyway, I ended up with four guitars one time in a trade. I traded one of those guitars for a really, really nice guitar because the guy really wanted it. And I told him, I was like, oh, I had cash. I knew I was getting way better of a deal. I was giving him an Epiphone Slash edition. I know you're all excited, right? And he was giving me an American-made Telecaster. No wows in the crowd? Okay, wow for myself then. Okay. He gives me this beautiful American-made Telecaster. And it's wasted on me, friends. I was like, oh my goodness, this is a really nice guitar beyond my playing ability, number one. And then number two, I don't want to mess it up. You know, I got way too many people in my house. But think about this. What if you had been there that day I got that American Telecaster and you said, hey, Paul, that is a pretty sweet axe. Where are you going to put that thing? And I said, I'm going to put it in the twins' room. I'm just going to hang it on the wall right there in the midst of a 7 and 26-year-olds. How much is that guitar worth, Paul? What's worth X amount of money? It's American made. It's nice. And you're like, you putting it where again? They're not going to touch it. They're kids. They don't want to touch the guitar hanging on the wall. I think you guys get it, right? How foolish would that be? You'd be like, oh my goodness, you have no idea how risky of a situation you're putting that thing of value in. Jesus here is trying to help remind them, whatever you think is so valuable here, whatever amount of money you're putting on these items, whatever you think it's affording you the ability to do, you've got the wrong understanding. It is perishable, it is stealable, and ultimately it just won't matter, will it? What you treasure, what I treasure, as we show in our time, as we show with our money, as we show with our priorities, as we show with our interests, as we show in what we conversate about, that reveals what we really believe is valuable. Jesus here is calling them to live a life that's consistently putting deposits up with God, not to earn forgiveness, not to earn even accolade as Christians wrongly think, but to show and evidence their submission to God, and not only their submission to God, but also His glory in and through their lives to draw more people. He says, live a life stacking heavenly treasures. Do you know why? Because the day will come where this audience, and even you and I today, we're going to die. Cheery news? Yes. You're going to die. You know that. You just don't know when. You don't know how. The day will come where I will stand before God, and you will stand before God. And it's not going to be a day where I bring up my cool American Telecaster or the net worth that I have on this or my house deed over there or what car I drove or what position I held in a company. None of that's going to be standing there with me with Jesus. I will be there barren before the God of the universe. And I will either stand impoverished as a damned sinner to be justly removed from His presence rightfully, or I'll be welcomed because of the righteousness of Christ having been applied and shared to me. But I won't be there with all the goodies of the earth as my evidence or my proof of. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. What we really value is understood in heaven, but friends, it's easily seen on earth by what you give your allegiance to. In time, and in treasures, for sure. The emphasis here is not just about this life. Jesus here is not just saying, oh, okay, give, give, give. He's saying, you need to be thoughtful about the coming kingdom. Are you prepared for it? Are you ready for it? That will be evidenced in how you live, what you live for, and why you live the way you do. He says, you better be ready. But then beyond that, what attitude should God's people have about the kingdom? If we're not to be fearful about it, we're to have a calmness and an understanding that it's worth conforming our life to, then what attitude should I have? We've already mentioned it. Live in anticipation. In verses 35 through 40, he starts giving some illustrations for their day and time, and even that we can relate to and understand logically today to understand what's going on here. In verses 38 through 40, he gives this idea of being prepared, and he gives some plot twists along the way. We start reading there in verse 35, what does Jesus start giving this image of? There's this image of a master coming back to his household and dealing with his servants, the people who worked for him there in the household. And he tells the servants in this illustration that they would be wise to be what? Girded up. Now, we don't really use that word anymore, right? When's the last time you told somebody you were girded, right? I don't know. Maybe you did. You're a weirdo. Girded. What's the idea in the Bible? The image of a man who's taken his what? The ends of his robe, and he's tucked them up into his belt. And what is he ready for? He's ready for war. He's ready to run and give a message, or he's ready for whatever activity is needed. So the symbolism here with the girdedness is readiness for whatever is required. He then gives the idea of them having their lamps ready with oil. We know their day and time without electricity, it was common to have oil burning lamps so that you could accomplish anything that was needed after the sun went down. The symbolism again is one of readiness due to having the ability to see in a dark area. Jesus gives this idea of this generous master coming on the scene. He's returned home from this wedding. It's a late hour. He's out there knocking on what was typical for a wealthy individual's home to have a courtyard and an exterior door. So he's about to get to the exterior door, and Jesus gives this idea that before maybe he even gets to the knock, what does one of the servants do? Welcome back, Jimmy. So glad you made it. How was the wedding? He rolls in as the master, and they're prepared for his arrival. But Jesus gives this plot twist. What if the master, with whom all the riches resided, they all belong to him, they all are at his dictation to use as he desires to. What if he, then as a way of thankfulness, presents some level of care or celebration or maybe even meal for his prepared servants. Now, somebody may say, what kind of time is Jesus talking about here? Well, he's writing to a Roman audience, so this could indicate, depending on the shift, somewhere around midnight, because they had shifts that went all night. Or if it's a Jewish audience, it could be the way they did shifts, about 2 a.m. But let's understand it. Jesus is giving this idea that it's not a convenient time to be alert, prepared, and awake. It's not a normal time to be prepared, alert, or awake, unless you have a newborn. That's about the only time you're up or prepared at these hours. And Jesus, in this weird illustration, says the servant that everything belongs to goes to the people who don't deserve it. And what does he do? He takes his riches and he cares for them and celebrates them simply for what? Being prepared. Nothing else. Because they were prepared for his arrival, he treats them well, and there is a good for them. There is a profit for them. There is a blessing for them. But then Jesus swaps the scenario entirely in verse 39 and 40. At verse 39, I want you to look back there and see how he goes from talking about like a wedding and everybody enjoying that. They're blessed servants at the end of verse 39, 8. And then in verse 39, he says, and this note, that if the good man of the house had known the hour, the thief would come. So earlier, he's talked about riches being subject to thievery. Now he's going to present himself as what in this illustration? He's the thief. And he gives this idea of, well, if you knew when you'd be robbed, what would you do different? If you all left church today and you got home and on your door was like this yellow post-it note said, hey, you don't know me. My name's Ned. I'll be at your house this morning at what will be tomorrow morning, about 1:38 a.m., give or take. You know that southeast door you never really pay attention to? I'm going to come through that door. See you then, winky face, winky face. I suspect you may have your German friends, Heckler and Koch, ready, or your American friends, Smith and Wesson, ready for that arrival of Ned, right? If you knew, it'd be easy. Jesus is saying what to them? I want you to understand, I'm not coming when you think. I'm not going to show up when it's convenient for you. I'm not going to do what you expect with the kingdom. You need to live in faithful anticipation of it. Verse 40, the illustration is very clear in Jesus' own words. Be therefore what? Ready. Just like an owner would be if he knew when a thief would come, so you and I need to be ready here and now. Why? Because he's coming when you or I or they least expect it. You can understand maybe in their own minds what they're starting to think. Okay, Jesus, but when? You're not telling us. And Jesus is saying what? Exactly. Well, we want to be ready. I want you to understand, Jesus isn't being coy. He's not trying to be annoying here to his listeners. He's not even trying to be unkind by not giving them the details. He's expecting them, as followers of his kingdom, to live in consistent, surrendered abandonment of this realm. For their spiritual betterment, yes, but also for his work, for his kingdom. He knows their sin nature. He knows what? Our sin nature. He knows that we're prone to get what? Focused on the wrong realm too easily. Each day, my Etch-a-Sketch brain, and likely your Etch-a-Sketch brain, needs what? This template laid on top of it. Yes, today I have to get up. I have this appointment, this meeting, that bill to pay, this child to pick up, this, that. And that's normal because it's just living in this realm. But you know what we need to do? As our brain starts ramping up and the gerbil gets on the wheel about today, we need to insert at the beginning of that, okay, all that's true, but what does the Lord want for me today? How am I going to be of service to him today? What's his kingdom going to take a step in today because of my yielded life? Yes, I have my life, ding, ding. But it's all under submission to his glory and for his future kingdom. Friends, for this Jewish crowd, the idea of his return would signify the end of what we would call linear time because of his earthly rule and fulfillment of the Abrahamic and the Davidic covenants being fulfilled in the fullest way possible. And they were to, from the Old Testament onward, live in anticipation of the Messiah. Now he's there in their midst, and he's telling them, my kingdom on earth is not yet. I will be working my work in and through your lives. Live in anticipation. You don't need to know it's happening next year. You don't need to know if it's happening in 7 years. You don't need to know if it's going to happen after you die. Christians have consistently what? Looked to the future for what God's fulfillment would be in and through our lives now to fulfill his promises later. As we come to a close this morning, and we'll pick this back up the next time we're together, I want to encourage you to ask yourself a serious question here. Jesus here is calling you to anticipation about his kingdom and living for it. Do you find yourself more at odds with verse 32 and guilty of it rather than accepting of it? What's he saying in verse 32? Fear not. To the followers of Christ in the room today, I'm asking you with the Holy Spirit's aid today to evaluate if you're living in anticipation, thankfulness, trust and dependence and submission to what Jesus has promised is your spiritual betterment, your spiritual best, his glory through your life, and his usage of your life by being surrendered to his kingdom mission for you? Or are you too wrapped up in this realm? And that sounds either unappealing, or you have some concerns, or you have some questions, you have some distrust about it. He's calling you and I today to do what? Let those go. Trust him as the promise giver. Trust him as the perfect high priest. Trust him as our great high king. And realize that when he does establish his kingdom, all that we've lived for will not be for naught. It will be right, and eternity will demonstrate the validity of his promises and our choices to surrender to him. But I would be remiss if I didn't speak to you today who maybe is an unbeliever. Maybe you're here today and you say, you know what? I'm familiar maybe with God, or I have my own ideas about God, religion, the Bible, church. I have my own ideas. Okay. I want you to ask what you're living for right now. And then what do you think about the day of your death? It's going to happen. You're going to stand there, and your agnosticism will have meant very little, because your skepticism will come to sight then. Your atheism, it will serve you no good to say, well, I'm one time through, YOLO, I'm going to die, and it's be it, and annihilationism, what we all experience, so live it up now in whatever way, academically, indulgently, whatever it is, I'm going to live it up now while I die. God's given you autonomy to be able to do that, but the day comes that you will die, and you may be all right. The Bible declares you will be all wrong. Listen, I'm willing to admit, I've not died. I don't know what's on the other side. I can look at God's word and say, here's what God said. Therefore, I'm going to side with him and put my confidence there. You may be right. It's going to be a long time in torment to be wrong. I want to appeal to you today, no matter if you find yourself as agnostic, atheist, even religious, I'm not asking so much of your titles as much as what are you doing about what you know is inside of you, your sin nature. And what are you doing about when you die, having confidence and assurance there?